Throughout the U.S., many migrants are facing horrific conditions, which has led to intense criticism of Biden's immigration policies from both Republicans and Democrats. In an election year, that's a harsh political reality.
Yeah. And can we expect then any change in policy, you think, anytime soon?
Yeah, I think so. Even as soon as next month, Congress is back in session and Republicans will continue asking for things like making it even more difficult to get asylum at the border and more deportations. I've spoken to advocates who worry that the U.S. could return to Trump-era policies when asylum seekers were turned away without a hearing. And when it comes to involving Mexico, advocates have real concerns about human rights violations. I mean, for years, we've been hearing reports of migrants being abused, kidnapped, and killed while trying to get through Mexico and seek asylum in the U.S. Now, the White House has said and repeated this week that it remains committed to protecting the rights of asylum seekers and refugees.
All right, well, we'll be keeping an eye on that. Jasmine Garst is NPR's immigration correspondent. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The war in Gaza is reshaping Israeli politics. It ended an effort by Benjamin Netanyahu's government to overhaul the judiciary, which many in Israel saw as an attempt to break the country's democracy. But as NPR's Frank Langfitt reports from Jerusalem, some who protested the legislation worried the threat could return.
This year, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government pushed for something called judicial reform. It was a dry-sounding package of legislation that convulsed the country. Many Israelis were so worried about the impact on their democracy, they took to the streets in the hundreds of thousands. It was a political awakening. One of the architects of the reform is Simcha Rothman, and he has this message.
When you talk about the judicial reform, I think it's dead.
Rothman chairs the Constitution, Law, and Justice Committee in the Knesset, Israel's parliament. This is a huge about-face. But Rothman says, with the country at war, it's time for unity.
I hope and I am certain that when the soldiers and their families will come back from the war, they will look at their elected officials and they will say, please stop stupid fights.
Many still distrust this government and fear that when the war ends, it could try again. Itzhak Burke is a retired university professor I met at a recent anti-government rally in Tel Aviv.
Until they're gone from power, nothing is dead. They're working on it constantly.
Critics say the government wants to control the courts, to erode minority rights, make it harder to fight official corruption, and pave the way for the annexation of the West Bank. And the fights aren't over. The government, which includes conservative religious parties, is still jockeying for control over Supreme Court appointments, according to Israeli media. This infuriates Gigi Levy-Weiss.
Have we learned nothing?
Levy Weiss is a well-known venture capitalist and a member of Brothers and Sisters in Arms, a group of military reservists who helped lead this year's pro-democracy protests.
How can it be that you're still thinking about how do I get what I want in this period? And the answer is that I think this is a government that is not thinking about its people. This is a government that is still busy with power grabs.
My name is Noah Sapat, and I am the executive director of the Association for Civil Rights in Israel,
which is essentially Israel's ACLU. The government claims it wants to reform the judiciary because the institution is unaccountable. But Sattat says the real goal is to weaken the court's ability to challenge government and parliamentary action.
The idea was to remove the checks and balances, which were very poor to begin with, and permit any government legislation.
Sattat says the system here is vulnerable to these kinds of tactics.
In Israel, we have no constitution. We have only one house of parliament. We have the very, very weak separation between the executive branch and the legislative branch. So the judicial system is really the main or even the only check and balance on government power.
And Sadat says the government is working on at least several dozen other bills to undermine the democratic system. In Israel, candidates can be banned from running for office if they've expressed support for terrorism. Sattat worries that the government will try to expand the definition of support to disqualify Palestinian political leaders.
To ban some of the political representation would be disastrous, both in the sense that it would change the political system altogether, but also because any minority that is not represented becomes radicalized.
So much has changed in Israel since October 7th, including Brothers and Sisters in Arms. On the day of the attack, the group pivoted away from protests against the judicial overhaul and rushed to rescue survivors. Like other volunteer groups, Brothers and Sisters filled a vacuum in the early days of the war, when the government was not only caught by surprise, but also slow to respond. Ronan Kohler is a former submarine captain, a founding member of the group. He says Brothers and Sisters has created 25 kindergartens in hotels where war evacuees are living.
Essentially, it's a room in the hotel that we equipped with toys and, you know, padded walls. And we hired a teacher. It's not very expensive. It's not very complicated.
Ann Kohler says members of Brothers and Sisters are thinking about other ways that they can affect change in Israel.
I think what I really would like to see is having some of our people as part of the Knesset.
Running for office.
Running for office. I think it's inevitable because this is the practical, pragmatic way to influence.
Such is the political evolution here in Israel. What many say began as a government attempt to undermine democracy may now inspire people to challenge that same government at the ballot box. Elections could come as early as next year. Frank Langford, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Online shopping. It's convenient until you gotta return something.
Yeah, and if you've got a holiday gift this year that you don't really want, well, you may find that more stores are charging fees or just making it plain harder for customers to send something back.
David Swartz is an analyst with Morningstar. He says retailers pay a big price for free returns.
A lot of brands are suffering from returns.
Stores took back $743 billion in returned merchandise this year. The National Retail Federation says that's almost 15% of the total sales. And Swartz says a lot of that stuff will not go back on the shelf.
Many products that are shipped back to stores are actually not resold. They're actually destroyed.
That makes returns costly for stores and the planet, Swartz says, since so many of those goods are destined for landfills.
Major retailers like Macy's and Amazon have tightened their return policies, but another analyst, Sucharita Kadali, says she won't be surprised if they loosen up again.
I don't see strict return policies lasting for that long. It's a pendulum that swings back and forth. It depends on economic sentiment, consumer confidence, whether or not the retailer is financially well positioned or not, how much inventory they have in stock, et cetera, et cetera.
And Kadali, who's an e-commerce expert at Forrester, says online shops are much more likely to charge for returns.
I generally don't see restocking fees for physical stores.
So her advice for the next holiday season, shop at a brick and mortar store and check the return policy before you buy anything. Later today on All Things Considered, we go to Arizona for a visit with some newly naturalized U.S. citizens. What do they value most about getting the chance to vote in America for the first time and participate in a treasured democratic process? This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition, and on WPR, it's 8:19 on this Thursday. Coming up on the program, Morning Edition staffers will reflect on some of the most memorable stories they worked on in 2023. Speaking of taking a look back, WPR's Rich Kramer joined the program earlier, helped us look at what the Wisconsin Supreme Court decision overturning the state's maps looks like. You can listen back to that at WPR.org, and you can also find it on our daily news podcast. That's called Wisconsin Today.
As the cold of winter approaches, warm yourself with beautiful music, friendly conversation, and stories that sparkle like falling snow. Hi, I'm Sarah Ashworth, director of WPR. This holiday season, we're here to keep you informed and entertained, whether you're at home, at work, or on the go. Find our complete schedule of programs at wpr.org/holidays, and thanks for listening.
Support for WPR comes from The Bolt Company, a family and employee-owned company dedicated to providing construction, technical, and real estate solutions in a variety of markets nationwide. Featured projects and more at bolt.com.
Support comes from the law offices of Frank J. Parise, specializing in criminal defense, traffic, and DUIs. 262-656-9906. The law offices of Frank J. Parise since 1985. Located in Kenosha at 7001 30th Avenue.
Rain and sleet expected to fall in the southern half of Wisconsin throughout the day today, with wind gusts up to 20 to 30 miles per hour and high temperatures in the 30s and 40s. Could see a lingering shower or two in the south early tomorrow, clearing throughout the day. Once again, highs in the 30s and 40s. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows and more information are at macfound.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Now, as hosts of this program, we usually say our names at the top of each story, but now we want to take a moment and highlight the names that you don't usually hear on the show.
We're talking about the talented and sleep-deprived editors and producers who bring you Morning Edition every single day. Here are some of their favorite stories of 2023.
I'm Claire Marashima. This year, I looked into quirky classes, including sheep management at the University of Maryland. Students are paired with a pregnant ewe to care for, and Professor Sarah Balcom said that they go to great lengths to see the baby lambs for the first time.
They have told me stories of waking up in the middle of the night and driving 45 minutes and trying hard not to speed because you're never quite sure if the cop's going to believe you that you're going to the birth of your lamb.
This class stuck with me because it's so different from the education I had growing up. One student told me the hands-on format helped with her learning disabilities.
Hey, I'm Lindsay Toddy. I'm a producer with Morning Edition. This summer, there was a social media trend where people were talking about a movie called Zapotha. The idea was that it was this 80s cult classic horror movie. But here's the thing. The movie doesn't exist. It all started with a musician in the United Kingdom named Emily Jeffrey. She got her TikTok followers to pretend they were fans of this old movie called Zapotha and post about it online, spreading the music she wrote as part of its soundtrack. Now, Jeffrey seemed to have this whole movie cooked up in her imagination, and she brought her fans in on the fun.
It'd be like the villain. Oh my God, it'd be the villain showing up at the end and like looking up at the camera after you think that they've like died. And then the end credits would roll, and it would be so cool. And then the song plays out as the credits are rolling. That's totally what it would be.
This just shows that people on the internet will create a community around just about anything. It was definitely the most fun story I worked on this year.
I'm Adam Byrne, and here at Morning Edition, sometimes we make stories happen that seem impossible to pull off when we first think of them. That happened in March, when, to mark the anniversary of the beginning of the war in Iraq, we brought together a US pilot who dropped bombs on Baghdad with a former resident of the city. Here's Shema Khalil and Steve Anchorstar.
Are you hopeful that things are going to be better in 20, 30 years from now between U.S. and Iraqi relations? Or are you pessimistic in that so much damage has been done that there might not be a good way forward in the future?
I think I have hope,
because if you don't have hope, we can't live. So as much as we can open spaces for learning from each other, I think this will make change.
My name is Milton Guevara. In September, I traveled with a Morning Edition team to a refugee camp in Adre, Chad. We were there to speak with people who fled their homes in Sudan because of the civil war. Salah Amira Omar was one of them.
I built all my life to make generation and make yours and did my best and force it to leave my house.
His story really stuck with me. Unfortunately, the war in Sudan continues to kill and displace thousands of people.
My name's Julie Dovenbrock. I'm a producer, and the most memorable story I worked on this year was about writer Elizabeth Rush's book, The Quickening, which chronicles her journey to Antarctica and motherhood. As someone who'd been covering climate change for years, Rush knew that seeing the melting ice might change her mind about bringing a child into this unstable world. But still, she went. I love this conversation with Rush because it was a rare story of hope and survival in a time that can feel really apocalyptic and scary.
There are many people on this planet who have lived through many different kinds of endings before. I think of the indigenous inhabitants of the Americas, like their worlds have been ending for five centuries. And at some level, of course, climate change is a different scale of transition. But I also think that these kinds of earth transformations have happened before, and there's a lot of wisdom in how to survive them.
This is Jan Johnson. The actor who played Dwight in The Office knows it's a little unexpected to hear him talk about finding meaning in life. But when Rainn Wilson spoke to Rachel Martin about a spiritual revolution and his book Soul Boom, he shared an anecdote that I'm taking to heart right about now. Here he is talking about what he called a transformative moment with the man behind the film classic, My Dinner with Andre.
I was fortunate as an actor to study with the great acting teacher, Andre Gregory, and he would meet with the students, and I had tea with him once, and he said, "How are you doing, Rainn?" And I said, "You know, Andre, I'm just feeling so cynical. I'm feeling pessimistic. The world is a pile of crap, and it's getting worse." And I'll never forget this experience. He grabbed my arm. I mean, even back then, he was like 80 years old. Now he's like 110. He grabbed my arm like a vice, and he looked into my eyes, and he said, "Stop it. Don't do it. Don't be cynical. If you're cynical, they win. You have to keep hope alive."
Some of the brilliant and dedicated staff of Morning Edition.
This is NPR News.
When an Illinois drug factory shut down this year, it worsened some drug shortages and left hospitals scrambling.
We actually got an email from our representative, and he just said, "We learned that we're closing. Everyone has to leave today." So it was very abrupt.
Now it's reopening under a new owner. More on what causes generic drug shortages and what's being done about it on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story, plus the day's news from 4 until 6:30 today on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
Good morning. Happy to have you with us for Morning Edition on this Thursday here on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:29 with news from NPR and WPR on the way.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The UN says 150,000 people have fled central Gaza in recent days as Israel expands its ground offensive against Hamas. The Gaza Health Ministry says more than 21,000 people have been killed by Israeli forces since they began responding to the militants' deadly assault in southern Israel on October 7th. Food, water, and other humanitarian aid remain difficult to find in Gaza. The World Health Organization is warning of the spread of infectious diseases at crowded refugee camps. Jose Andres is a chef and the founder of World Central Kitchen, which is helping to feed Palestinians in Gaza.
Many Palestinians I've been able to speak to, and many tell me, I don't have an issue with Israeli people. I don't have an issue with Jewish people. I only want the best for my family, for my children.
He was speaking to NPR's Morning Edition. The Republican Party in Colorado says it's appealing a ruling from the state Supreme Court banning former President Donald Trump from Colorado's presidential primary ballot. The former president has said he also plans to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Earlier this month, Colorado's Supreme Court ruled Trump was ineligible to appear on the primary ballot in 2024 because his actions leading up to January 6th amounted to insurrection. This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. High schoolers across the state can learn about personal finance while earning college credit thanks to a program at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. Wisconsin high school students will have to complete at least a half credit of personal finance literacy to graduate under a new law signed by Governor Tony Evers. Cliff Robb is a professor of consumer science at University of Wisconsin-Madison. He said bad actors count on people's ignorance, so he thinks it's important for schools to prioritize teaching students about handling money.
I think that's a huge disservice to expect people to kind of like enter an advanced economy with no training on how that economy operates and what the products are in that economy.
Research shows people who learn about finances save more in the future. Personal Finance 101 is offered through the UW-Whitewater Partners in Education program. Students can take the class online. Milwaukee has more than 3,200 vacant city-owned lots. Evan Casey has more on a new initiative to turn some of those spaces into areas for the community to gather.
Milwaukee launched the Healing Spaces Initiative in 2021, largely in response to the isolation many were feeling during the COVID-19 pandemic. The goal is to transform blighted lots into green spaces with gardens and areas to relax. Angela Mitchell-Reed is a community outreach liaison for the program. She wants them to be used in a variety of ways.
While we've built out these spaces, we want people to know that they can bring town hall meetings, yoga sessions, healthy eating workshops, even therapy opportunities to these spaces at no cost to them. And it's a way to engage the public and to utilize our vacant spaces.
There are currently 14 healing spaces in Milwaukee, most of them run by churches, neighborhood groups, or community organizations. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Former U.S. Senator from Wisconsin Herb Kohl has died. The Herb Kohl Foundation reported the news yesterday, saying he died at the age of 88 after a brief illness. Kohl's family owned and operated several department store chains and grocery stores under the same name. Kohl was also the owner of the Milwaukee Bucks from 1985 through 2014. Kohl was elected to the U.S. Senate four times. He served from 1989 until 2013. He also served as the chairman of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. From the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities. And from Heather Sturt Haga and Paul G. Haga, supporting African Wildlife Foundation, working to ensure wildlife and wild lands thrive in modern Africa. Learn more at awf.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The Endangered Species Act turns 50 today. It was born out of a growing realization in the Nixon era that America could lose its wildlife to, quote unquote, progress. I spoke with Deborah Sivas, a professor of environmental law at Stanford University. She talked about what the act was intended to do.
So the purpose of the ESA was to really triage species that were on the brink of extinction. And when it was adopted in the 1970s, there were plenty of species that were facing extinction. And the idea is to list them and give them additional protection with the hope that the populations will recover and they will eventually come off of the list. So I think of it as like an emergency room in a hospital where you bring the species into protection, you patch them up, you patch the populations up, and then, you know, hopefully they go on and survive and thrive.
Sivas points out the ESA was signed before lawmakers were really aware of climate change. He says the law needs to be updated.
Over the years, especially in the last 2 to 3 decades, it's really been under constant assault, right? It changes when a different presidential administration comes in or a shift in Congress. And it's sort of in a constant battle to survive. And given how polarized we are, I question whether it can survive. But right now, you know, right now it's being protected by champions both in the White House and the Congress. But I think its future remains precarious.
If you could update one part of the Endangered Species Act, what would it be?
Well, as I mentioned, there's concerns about how it interacts with climate change. So you need to think carefully about how to do that. But to me, one of the things that is really needed is we focus on species, and that was what was in the minds of Congress back in the 1970s. You know, there were certain species that were iconic, like the bald eagle and others. But really, we need to focus on ecosystems and the habitat where the species lives. So there have been lots of proposals to think about how we could reform the ESA to really make it an ecosystem protection law as opposed to just a species protection law.
How would things change if it was indeed changed to ecosystems as opposed to just species?
Well, it would be more reflective of conservation biology, the science behind it, right? Which is so often what we do now is we have a species that gets listed and they really provide a proxy for protection of a larger ecosystem. So the example I always give back in the 1990s is the northern spotted owl. And yes, were people concerned about the owl? Yes. But really, it was used as a proxy to protect old growth forests in the Northwest, right? But that seems like it's not really the scientifically correct. We should be looking at the whole ecosystem and what that ecosystem needs in terms of protection.
I know that there are a lot of names on the list. What is your favorite species that has been saved or helped by the ESA?
Here in California, one of my favorites is the condor. So I live not too far from Pinnacles National Park, which is a habitat for condor, and you know, have hiked up there, and they're these majestic birds, and they were also brought back in California from the brink of extinction through ESA type protections.
Condor's a good one. I live in California too. Condor is definitely a good one. Yeah, absolutely. This is just kind of a random question on my part. Of all the creatures on the list, if you could just talk to one, Deborah, which one would it be, and what would you want to know?
Well, I'm particularly fond of the gray wolves, and really they've made a comeback in the West. Under the Endangered Species Act, they've been protected. They're now less protected than they were, but they were protected for many years and reintroduced into Yellowstone. And if you live out West, you know that they've really radiated out from Yellowstone all the way into California, and they just roam all over the landscape, right? And which is one of the reasons why they're in trouble, because they interact with humans, you know, everywhere they go. But I would love to be in their shoes.
Or their paws, I guess, right?
Or paws. Or
in this case, right? Yeah. Deborah Sivas, professor of environmental law at Stanford Law School. Deborah, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
The issue of abortion is mobilizing voters across the country, and Democrats have largely been seeing the benefits ever since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade. They have been pushing to codify abortion access into state law, and political strategists are zeroing in on Arizona as the next battleground. NPR's Jimena Bustillo reports.
Arizonans looking to expand access to abortion in the Grand Canyon state are already gathering outside courthouses.
They were there because the state Supreme Court is weighing abortion restrictions. But they're not just protesting outside the court. They're hard at work mobilizing to get a ballot initiative that would enshrine abortion rights in the state constitution.
We knew we needed to do something for 2024.
That's Chris Love, a senior advisor of Planned Parenthood of Arizona, one of the organizations behind the initiative.
We are well ahead of where we anticipated we would be, and we are on track to, you know, producing about 800,000 signatures when all is said and done by July 3rd.
If approved by voters, the constitutional amendment would override whatever conclusion the state Supreme Court comes to.
That's the point, right? Our court shouldn't be deciding any of these things. These decisions should be between a pregnant person and their trusted medical provider.
Those on the other side are gearing up too. Groups like Students for Life of America, who want to restrict abortion access, are preparing to fight the efforts in Arizona.
These young people can be reached, and they can vote pro-life, but we have to speak to them and be real with them about what's really at stake.
That's Kristen Hawkins, Executive Director of Students for Life of America. Hawkins said they plan to increase their presence on college campuses in the state and target ads at younger voters. Young voters tend to favor abortion rights, but recent polling shows that the issue can still motivate young conservatives.
Far too often, Republican pundits and even Republican campaigns, they just fail to reach out to this demographic, thinking that it's a lost cause. By winning a couple more percentage points of young people, that can shift the entire election.
And that can certainly be the case in the swing state of Arizona. In 2020, President Biden won the state by just 10,000 votes. And key Senate and House races that could determine who controls Congress will be on the ballot.
And specifically, this path runs straight through Arizona.
That's Danny Wang. She's the deputy director for campaign communications at Emily's List, which helps elect Democratic women who support abortion rights. She says voters are eager to defend abortion protections.
I think they're incredibly invigorated to go out to the ballot box because it doesn't matter if you live in a state where abortion is constitutionally protected or if you live in Arizona where the fate rests on this upcoming election.
Abortion-related initiatives have proved to be a major voter mobilizer. Democrats have seen these wins in states like Montana, Kentucky, Michigan, and Ohio over the last 2 years. And organizers hope Arizona is next. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News, Phoenix.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Really happy to have you with us at 8:42 on this Thursday. And still plenty more to get to here on the program. We're going to hear about dams and climate change among the threats facing Southeastern Asia's famed Mekong River. Cambodia is now scrapping plans for two new dams, but is that going to be enough to save that river's biodiversity? That story is coming up still this hour on Wisconsin Public Radio.
PBS Wisconsin Education and the Wisconsin School Music Association have partnered with music educators to create ReSound, Songs of Wisconsin, a free collection of classroom media resources featuring contemporary Wisconsin musicians. The collection is designed to help general music educators and learners explore the connections between music, culture, identity, and emotion. Access lesson plans and more. Visit pbswisconsineducation.org.
Support for WPR comes from the state of Wisconsin, the federal government, business sponsors, and more than 50,000 members who contribute. Thank you to everyone who makes Wisconsin Public Radio available around the state and at WPR.org.
Support comes from the Kenosha Community Foundation, a public charity that encourages community members to build a legacy for themselves and their families through tax-advantaged giving. To learn how, visit KenoshaFoundation.org or call 262-654-2412.
Some public radio at 844. Here's what's happening in news. The United Nations says the fighting between Israel and Hamas is impeding badly needed aid trucks from entering into Gaza. This, as Israel announces, it has expanded its offensive into the central part of the territory. The Colorado Republican Party says it will appeal the state Supreme Court's decision banning former President Trump from the 2024 ballot to the U.S. Supreme Court. Former U.S. Senator from Wisconsin Herb Kohl has died at the age of 88. He was elected to the Senate four times, serving from 1989 until 2013. The Universities of Wisconsin Board of Regents voted unanimously yesterday to fire UW lacrosse chancellor, reportedly after learning he was appearing in pornographic videos online. More news at WPR.org. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox with Archie, the man who became Cary Grant, a new original drama following the rise of a Hollywood icon. Archie, now streaming at BritBox.com/NPR. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at NerviveHealth.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid.
And I'm A. Martinez. Scientists think that when it comes to global heat, 2023 will be one for the record books. Temperatures around the world were extremely hot, but will it be the hottest year ever recorded? Lauren Sommer from NPR's Climate Desk is here with the answer. Lauren, I'm on the edge of my seat. Where does 2023 rank?
Yeah, so there are a few days of December left, of course, but it's virtually certain that 2023 will be the hottest year on record. That's in the last century and a half where humans have measured the temperature, and it's likely going back the last 125,000 years where scientists have reconstructed the temperature record. You know, the second half of 2023 had some really hot months globally, like September, that pushed it over the top, and this caps what's already a really hot decade. The past 8 years have been the hottest eight on record.
So is this something that scientists expected, or is it something about climate change that's somehow speeding up?
Yeah, you know, it's something climate scientists are watching closely. Some say it could be accelerating, but others say, you know, there needs to be more data, more information from future years to say that. I talked to Zeke Hausfather, a climate scientist at Berkeley Earth, which is a nonprofit that analyzes climate trends. And he says a year like this one has a clear link to all the fossil fuels that humans are burning.
We know why this is happening. You know, a year like this would not have occurred without the trillion tons of carbon that we've put into the atmosphere over the last century.
Yeah, and we've seen what the world looks like and feels like at these kind of temperatures this year. A lot of disasters. I remember Arizona, Phoenix, Arizona was so hot at one point where it was just insane how hot it was there.
Yeah, that was record breaking. You know, over the summer, Phoenix spent 31 days above 110 degrees. More than 500 people died in the area from heat-related causes. But it wasn't alone. You know, China, Southern Europe, Mexico all saw extreme heat waves. And Christy Ebi, who is a scientist at the University of Washington who studies heat, says, you know, that should be a wake-up call.
The major lesson is how unprepared we are, that there are places with heat wave early warning and response systems. They certainly saved lives. They didn't save enough.
You know, there were also heat waves in the ocean. In July, the water off Florida hit 100 degrees, which is, you know, hot tub level, basically. Corals really can't survive that temperature, and there was a major die-off on the reef there.
Okay, so that's 2023, which is almost over. Can we start a clean slate, Lauren, for 2024, or is 2024 going to take over the top spot?
You know, there's a decent chance it might take the top spot because right now, an El Nino climate pattern is beginning. It basically means a whole bunch of heat that's been stored in the ocean gets released into the atmosphere. So El Nino years are hot years, and this is a strong El Nino. But even if next year doesn't take that top spot, you know, scientists say this trend will continue, like Tessa Hill, who is a marine scientist at the University of California, Davis.
If we don't change things, if we keep going on the trajectory we're going, we will look back at 2023 and think of it as, you know, remember that year that wasn't so bad.
She says, you know, every little bit that humans can do to cut greenhouse gas emissions and reduce the use of fossil fuels will help slow this trend. And there is still time to do that.
That's Lauren Sommer from NPR's Climate Desk. Lauren, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on WPR. I'm glad you're with us. About 11 minutes left in the hour now. If you want to listen back to our conversation with WPR's Rich Kramer, who joined us earlier in the show talking about the Wisconsin Supreme Court declaring the state's current maps unconstitutional and sending them back to the drawing board, you can hear that at WPR.org. And you can also find it on our daily news podcast, Wisconsin Today. You just search for that wherever you get your podcasts.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the 2024 Jeans Jazz Series will open with the James Jorgen Sextet on Saturday, January 6th at 7 p.m. at the Racine Theater Guild in Racine. For more information, visit racinetheater.org.
The state organization of the National Alliance on Mental Illness.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. In sports, the Milwaukee Bucks beat the Brooklyn Nets last night 144-122. Giannis Antetokounmpo led the way with 32 points and 10 rebounds. The Bucks will wrap up their road trip tomorrow night with a game against the Cleveland Cavaliers. That one is set to start at 6:30. In weather, rain and sleet across the southern half of the state today. Northern half might stay dry with highs in the 30s and 40s. Could see a lingering shower or two in the south heading into Friday, but things clear up across the state by the afternoon. Highs once again in the 30s and 40s tomorrow. On Saturday, it'll be sunny with a brief chance for a few flurries later on in the day in the northern part of the state. Tad bit cooler than the past few days with highs in the 30s across Wisconsin. I'm Alex Crow. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Asma Khalid. Southeast Asia's famed Mekong River is under threat. Chinese dams upriver and climate change are partly to blame, but dams downriver are also having an effect. And some countries are starting to respond. Cambodia recently announced it was scrapping plans for two new dams. But the question is it enough to save the river's biodiversity? NPR's Michael Sullivan reports.
Khao Phraya is a small island in the middle of the Mekong in northern Cambodia, accessible only by a rickety single-car ferry. It's a remote stretch of muddy brown river where residents eke out a living growing vegetables and fishing. And last year came the biggest fish story of them all.
We caught it at about 4 in the afternoon and got it to the boat about 5 hours later. I thought it was about 80 kilograms, but when I finally saw it up close, I said, oh my God, it is so big.
How big? The giant stingray Multone and his crew caught weighed in at 661 pounds, the largest freshwater fish ever recorded. And when Chia Sela got a phone call alerting her to the catch, she jumped in a car immediately for the seven-hour drive from the capital, Phnom Penh.
If we don't go immediately, I'm afraid that the fisherman, he decide to sell.
Because big fish can mean big money if cut up and sold in the local market. Sela is with the Wonders of the Mekong project, funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development. She paid the fisherman for the stingray once she got there. Then it was time to name her, an auspicious name.
And I just check the calendar. It's the full moon day. Okay, so I name her Boramai.
Boramai, or full moon in Khmer. She and her team measured it, weighed it, tagged it, and then she and about a dozen others gently eased the huge creature back into the current and released her.
Bye-bye.
But it wasn't really goodbye, because Boramai is now in the system.
This fish was tagged with an acoustic tag that emits a ping, and so we've been able to track the movement of the world's largest freshwater fish for the last year and learn about its behavior.
That's fish biologist Zeb Hogan of the University of Nevada, Reno, and the leader of the Wonders of the Mekong project.
This area, it's not only home to the giant freshwater stingray, it's home to other critically endangered species as well. It's home to the last population of Irrawaddy dolphin, giant turtles, giant Mekong catfish, seven-striped barb. So these are critically endangered fish, this is the only place in the world where all of these endangered species occur together.
And that makes the Cambodian government's decision to cancel two proposed mainstream dams so important. One would have been not far downriver from here. The bad news? The government of neighboring Laos plans another, the Phu Noi Dam, not far upstream.
If the Phu Noi Dam is built, it is the death knell for the Mekong fishery.
Brian Eiler is director of the Stimson Center's Southeast Asia program and the author of Last Days of the Mighty Mekong.
This won't be a gradual loss situation. It's going to be quick. The fishery will collapse. Tens of millions of people who get their food from the river are going to suffer immediately. It's just the absolute wrong place to build a Mekong mainstream dam.
He says that's because the dam will severely restrict access to Cambodia's Tonle Sap Lake, the so-called beating heart of the lower Mekong ecosystem.
The rule of thumb with building dams in the Mekong is that the closer they are to the Tonle Sap Lake, the more impactful they're going to be. And that's because tens of millions of fish move in and out of the lake each year. It is the world's largest migration of animals. You just can't see it because it's underwater. And a large portion of that migration is going to pass through where this Phu Noi Dam is being built.
Or not pass through, he says, since no fish ladders or other mitigation efforts will be nearly effective enough, he says, to allow that many fish to migrate successfully. The community leader here, fisherman Peng Boon, is concerned too. We're sitting in a small boat next to one of the floating receivers used to track the fish, right about where he thinks Boramai could be lurking below.
We have to be worried about three things. The first is the dam, the second is climate change, and the third is people. More people also means more pressure on the river.
And Laos's plan to lift itself out of poverty by using hydropower to become the battery of Southeast Asia doesn't seem to be working, with the country sinking deeper into debt even as it continues to build more dams. Brian Eiler says the Phu Noi Dam won't help.
There are forces at work within Thailand making a case to the new government there as to why this is a really bad idea. And note I said Thailand and not Laos, because Thailand is the major purchaser of power from this dam, and it's going to light up shopping malls in Bangkok for, you know, the death of the Mekong fishery.
And Thailand already has an ample energy surplus, he says, but has already signed power purchase agreements with Laos for two more dams on the Mekong, including one just above the World Heritage Site of Luang Prabang, that he says will essentially turn that stretch of the Mekong into a lake. Pianporn Dite is Southeast Asia campaign director for the advocacy group International Rivers.
So I would say that, yeah, anything can happen anytime, but I think more and more people are asking critical question about legitimacy of signing new power purchase agreement with Mekong hydropower dams.
Neither the Lao government nor the Thai developer responded to queries about the Phu Noi Dam, and a spokesman for the Mekong River Commission says the proposal is still in its early stages. Chia Se La of the Wonders of the Mekong Project hopes that's as far as it gets, and hopes the title of Brian Eiler's book, Last Days of the Mighty Mekong, is wrong.
We try to make everyone understand about the value of the Mekong River. I believe that it's not the last day of the Mekong.
And it might not be the last days of record-breaking fish either. Locals claim they've seen a stingray even bigger than Boramai. Further proof the river is incredibly resilient, at least for now. Michael Sullivan, NPR News, Khao Phraya, Cambodia.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid.
And I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Alex Crow, and that'll do it for Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's about 1 minute before 9 o'clock now on this Thursday. Thanks so much for spending part of your morning with us. Thanks to Joe Schultz for helping to bring us the news this morning. That news is on the way.
Support for WPR comes from Rogers Behavioral Health, providing specialized residential and outpatient care for OCD and anxiety, depression, addiction, and eating disorders throughout Wisconsin. RogersBH.org.
Support for Marketplace comes from Offsite, an infrastructure and IT services company. Offsite provides managed cybersecurity services to help protect your IT infrastructure, both on-premises and in the cloud. Visit off-site.com/radio.
Madison.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.